This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Marjorie Essman. She is Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Louisiana. She's held that post for almost 7 years, and we will talk with Marjorie about criminal justice issues in our state and also about a major forum tonight in Baton Rouge featuring the ACLU and the Pelican Institute, among others. Also on the show, we are scheduled to hear from Tom Aswell of Louisiana Voice. He calls Governor Jindal the prophet-in-chief, that's P-R-O-P-H-E-T, after the governor's remarks in California last week saying President Obama is depriving Americans of religious liberty. And if things go according to plan, we'll also hear from Southern University Chancellor Jim Lorenz. He's been in the news, may be out of a job if things go as they are planned right now. Now the news. To 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Sashika Marchand producing. And our guest to begin is Marjorie Essman. For 7 years, she's been head of the ACLU of Louisiana. Tonight, this organization, along with the Pelican Institute for Public Policy, a group that is in many cases not in line with the ACLU on certain issues, but on this one they have converged to bring the message to the people of Louisiana that it's time to reform the state's criminal justice system. Safe and Fair Louisiana, a forum on criminal justice, tonight at 7 p.m. at Shiloh Baptist Church, 185 Eddie Robinson Drive, and others who will be on hand include Senator Dan Clater, State Representative Dalton Honore, and Judge Ricky Wicker. Good morning, Marjorie Essman.
Good morning. You forgot to mention that you'll be there, too.
Yeah, I'll be there. I'll be kind of moderating or whatever it's called, facilitating. Uh-huh. But you'll be doing the talking. And why do we have the highest incarceration rate of any place on the face of the earth? Why?
Well, I wish there were a simple answer, because if there were a simple answer, there'd be a simple fix. But, you know, there are a lot of things that have gone into that over a long period of years. At one time, there was a belief, which has turned out not to be borne out by the numbers, but there was a belief that harsher sentences would lead to a reduction in crime rate. And so Louisiana, along with other states, went on a kind of a campaign to increase sentences for all sorts of offenses, thinking that that would be a deterrent. It hasn't turned out that way. What we have instead is a situation where longer sentences have, in fact, led to an increase in crime rather than a decrease in crime. And now that we know that, it's time to fix that. What we've seen in other states is that with a concerted effort, and, you know, it obviously has to be done the right way, but if you reduce sentences for nonviolent offenses, and if you make it easier for people who have been brought into the criminal justice system to reenter society productively, you can end up with a reduction in crime and also saving a lot of money.
Well, can policymakers, Marjorie, take steps to lower the prison population and improve public safety at the same time?
Without question, they can. And, you know, there have been a number of bills that have made their way through the legislature and more that will be coming up this coming session intended to do that. One of the things that we've done, and it's a small effort, but it's an important one, is to, for instance, make it easier for certain nonviolent offenders to get parole hearings. The idea being that, and this only applies to nonviolent and non-sex offenders, which are mostly, not exclusively, but mostly people doing long-term sentences for drug offenses. You know, if after you've served a period of time, you can demonstrate to a committee that you are not a danger to society and that you have skills that you can safely bring back into society and become productive, you ought to have the right to make your case. That doesn't mean that everybody's going to get out, but it does mean that if you're not dangerous, you ought to at least have the right to a hearing to demonstrate that you deserve to be released. You know, another thing is what we've realized is excessively long sentences for drug offenders has cost the state a huge amount of money, and these are people who aren't dangerous. Some of them may have addiction issues. Some of them may not. They're just recreational drug users. And it doesn't really serve any useful purpose for Louisiana, for instance, to allow a sentence of up to 20 years for a third-time marijuana, somebody's caught third-time marijuana use. You know, everybody knows somebody who's been in possession of marijuana, and everybody knows somebody who's been in possession of marijuana three times. And yet under Louisiana law, that person could be sentenced to up to 20 years. That doesn't make sense, and we need to fix that.
297-5633 if you'd like to engage Marjorie Essman, the executive director of the ACLU of Louisiana. In a column that ran in The Advocate a few weeks ago, James Gill notes that as of last year, the state had 1,372 citizens in prison for simple possession of pot. Average sentence was 8.4 years, and 10 of the inmates are doing life for possession of marijuana in Louisiana.
Without parole.
Without parole. So yeah, how does this happen?
Well, it happens because under current Louisiana law, a third-time marijuana user can be charged as a habitual offender if they have other felonies that can bring what would otherwise be a simple marijuana charge up to a habitual offender, and that gets you life without parole. But many of these people are not violent people. They're people with drug problems. They're people who, you know, may have committed, you know, burglary and theft and, you know, crimes that are serious for which people obviously need to be punished and society needs to be protected, but not necessarily life without parole forever if there's a way to rehabilitate them and get them back and be productive.
297-5633. We'll go to the phone lines in just a moment, but 8.4 years is the average for possession of marijuana. Now, Marjorie's in New Orleans. I've been to the Jazz Fest, as I'm sure many of our listeners have, and there's a lot of pot smoking going on by doctors and lawyers, and they're able to do it without any problem, and then others have possession of marijuana and go to jail for 8.4 years or life. There seems to be a disparity here.
Well, there are enormous racial disparities in sentencing for marijuana, and it isn't necessarily that there is deliberate racism in the system in terms of the trials and the sentences, but who gets arrested and prosecuted, there are enormous race disparities. And you just pointed out, you know, one issue when you've got professionals who, yes, at places like the Jazz Fest where it's out in the open, and yet in some parts of Louisiana, if you are an African-American male, you are 3 to 5 times as likely as a white person to be arrested and prosecuted for marijuana possession. And that's with statistics that show that the use of marijuana is pretty consistent across racial groups. So this does allow for selective prosecution. And prosecutors will essentially admit that because what the district attorneys say is that they don't really care about getting somebody who's just a pothead. What they do like to do is be able to use marijuana possession as a tool to get people that they say are more dangerous, violent criminals, which means essentially that they use it to prosecute the people they want and not the people they don't want. And that's a problem. We ought not to have laws that our law enforcement people admit they don't really care about.
We'll go to the phone lines in just a moment, but of those doing time for possession, 78% are African American. The population of the state is 32% African American, so to do the math, that means you're, I guess, about 2.5 times more likely to be prosecuted if you're black than if you're white for the same offense.
And in some places, it's even more than that. The statistics are even more skewed in some parishes.
Donald in Mid-City, you're on with Marjorie Essman.
Hello, how's it going, sir?
It's going well. What's your question?
Yes, well, I happen to be African-American. I don't smoke, and I don't smoke marijuana, but I've been in courts. I work in the courts. And one of the problems are the representation with people and the socioeconomic difference according to who you are and who you can have to represent you, and it's really unfair. And also, I'm concerned with this high rate of heroin deaths in East Baton Rouge Parish in South Louisiana recently. And I'm wondering how the legislature is going to focus on that. And to me, that's a matter of life and death.
All right. What about heroin? One lawmaker wants to increase the penalty for heroin to four times to what it is now. Is that a solution?
Well, first of all, I want to make it clear that there's a distinction between use and distribution. And none of the particularly in the context of marijuana, the changes that we've been talking about have to do with distribution. They only have to do with use. So I want to make that clear. And I think that there is room for discussion about the dangers of distributing heroin, and particularly nowadays when the strains are laced with more dangerous chemicals. But that's really a very different conversation than what we want to do with use of small amounts of marijuana. There is a bill to enhance penalties for heroin distribution, and I think that's a conversation that needs to be had. I don't think that it's going to change anything, because if somebody wants to get heroin, they'll find a way to get it, and they'll find a way to get whatever they can, which might be more dangerous. But a conversation about how to punish people who are doing harm to others is a conversation we need to have, but that's a very different conversation from what to do with people who are not doing harm to others.
Bruce and Walden. Hi, Bruce. You're on with Marjorie.
Yeah, hello. I've read Michelle Washington's New Jim Crow about five times. Just to give it a plug, it's the most brilliant work on the racism involved in the so-called war on drugs. But
that's Michelle Alexander, I assume you meant, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Michelle Alexander. Yeah, she's terrific. She actually spoke here last year. So just a couple of things. One is she really emphasizes the role of the prosecuting attorney as like the dictator in the situation. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that. She also mentioned that there's big money in the war on drugs.
Big money on the war on drugs and the role of the prosecutor.
Well, yes. I mean, I said earlier that the prosecutors play a huge role in who they choose to prosecute, and they essentially admit it in Louisiana when they say they only use the three-strike habitual offender piece against people that they know are what they call, you know, bad actors in the community. But, of course, that can be very subjective. And so, yes, there's a huge amount of prosecutorial discretion, and it's a serious problem. And big money in the war on drugs, without question there's big money in the war on drugs. It was designed that way. It was designed as a way to initially to reward states and communities that enhance the penalties. Again, the theory maybe was a good one, that it would be a deterrent. It hasn't turned out that way.
Jim, hold on. We'll get to the chancellor in just a bit, but Charles on North Foster. Charles on North Foster, you're on the air with Marjorie Essman of the ACLU. Hi, Charles.
Good morning, gentlemen. Good morning, Marjorie. I've heard the statistics and the alarming rate of disparity between how marijuana cases and other cases are prosecuted in Louisiana. My question for Ms. Marjorie is this. If the ACLU knows this, where is the federal lawsuit against the state of Louisiana? And if there isn't one, I'm at a loss for words. And why haven't we challenged the lack of dedicated funding for public defenders in cases like this? I mean, I'm just astounded that there's nothing pending in federal court.
Well, that's a very complicated issue, and I'm certainly never going to discuss legislative strategy on the air, but I will say this. You bring up a very important issue about the public defender problem in Louisiana, which is huge. We do not fund our public defenders adequately. We fund them in entirely the wrong way on the backs of the people they're supposed to represent. So from a funding system, and I'm not saying that this is how individual lawyers behave, because I don't think it is, but from a funding system, they get rewarded for losing cases. That doesn't make sense. And so we do have situations where in many communities the public defender system is totally inadequate for the needs of the community. That's a serious, serious problem. It's a legislative problem, and it needs to be addressed with a legislative scheme to fund the defenders both, with better resources and also with a scheme that makes more sense.
And tonight at 7 o'clock at Shiloh Baptist Church, Eddie Robinson Drive, Marjorie Essman, Kevin Kane of the Pelican Institute, Judge Ricky Wicker, Senator Dan Clater, and State Representative Dalton Honore will participate in a forum moderated by yours truly. Thank you, Marjorie. See you tonight, and
sure.
Look forward
Thank
to the
you.
Conversation.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And we'll be back with Chancellor Jim Lorenz. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Inkster Show at WRKF.org online. Dr. Jim Lorenz, appointed Chancellor of Southern University by the Board of Supervisors in April of 2011. He previously served at Southern from 1989 to 2008. And he is a graduate of Loyola New Orleans, master's from the University of Wisconsin, PhD from LSU. And Jim Lorenz is a man who is here to talk about a few different things, but obviously the big story about him is that a week ago Friday, the Board of Supervisors at Southern voted 9-6 not to renew his contract. There was a big rally last week in support of the chancellor, who obviously has backing from the students. But as we speak right now, what happens on June 30th, Jim Lorenz?
Well, you know, as you may be aware, the board called a special meeting on next Monday at 1:30 on February 24th. They'll revisit the issue of the contract. Not sure what will happen at that meeting, but that was, you know, we'll see. Yeah, I think we're prepared to go forward with the idea that we've done a lot at the university and face some major challenges with that. So that's, you know, we'll wait and see what happens on the 24th, Jim.
Would you like to stay?
Of course. I mean, I think this is, you know, when I came on board, I think I didn't at the time knew there were some problems, didn't realize the true impact of the tremendous budget cuts that have been imposed on the university over the past several years. So it's a matter of overcoming that. You know, it's a difficult process in trying to really re-strengthen the university, rebuild the enrollment, and it's a challenge going forward, but it's one that, you know, that I believe we're heading in the right direction.
You got a standing ovation last week when you went before the students. I'm sure that was heartening.
Oh, it was. I love them. I believe that, you know, they are, you know, what we're here for, obviously. And I was proud that, you know, they took a stance no matter what. It's always heartening to see students speak up, become involved in their university and in the decision-making at that university. So whichever way this happens, I'm very proud of those students.
Now, you've been careful to say that you have no beef with the president of the Southern system, that this is a matter of policy, that if the board had its way, you would be stripped of your authority. Is that basically what this is all about?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it's difficult, and yeah, I mean, I obviously called him to talk about the centennial, but yeah, I think it's a number of factors that go into discussion, into this evaluation. You know, obviously there, you know, we all have timelines and benchmarks of where we want to go and what we need to accomplish, and it's just a matter of deciding what those are, what we can you know, what we can agree on, the circumstances going forward, any stipulations going forward. You know, I believe that the chancellor has to maintain the authority to, you know, to control and be the decision maker for campus activities. You know, we also understand we're part of a system, the president runs the system, and we have to work, you know, as a partners. And, you know, that's, you know, like I said, that's just something that you know, still has to be ironed out. I know there are challenges going forward, and there are challenges both on the campus and system-wide that we have to address.
And amid this distraction, and obviously it is a huge one, you are preparing for the centennial. Southern University has been a great entity in this community for a century, and I know this is something that you take great pride in as one who has been at the university for as long as you have.
Yes, it is. And when we, last year, in fact, when I first came back as chancellor, we started looking at and going through the university files, university records, and it sort of struck me that this year would be 100 years in Baton Rouge, and I thought that was an opportunity for us to celebrate that occasion. And that's what we've been planning on, since, sort of almost the middle of last year, organizing a broad-based committee, steering committee to work with us. And that's been alumni, student groups, sort of everyone involved in that. And so it hadn't been definitely hadn't been one or two persons getting together and saying this is what we're going to do, but it's been that input. And we really got started. Back in October of last year, we had what we called a pre-centennial homecoming ecumenical service. Bishop Walker out of Tennessee came in, a grad who has a tremendous ministry in Nashville, and he came in and sort of got us started and actually made a contribution to the band. He's a former member of the band. In December, we had our Christmas extravaganza where we highlight the talents of the band and the choir and get community, even some community talent in there. And that's been a great turnout where we showcase again the talents of our students and our alumni really enjoyed it. It's a free event. Kids come out. We had a couple of schools, elementary schools that brought their kids out. And it was just a great time to sort of kicking off what we're doing. So the first real event of the celebration is tomorrow night. In what we call a student showcase, a student extravaganza. And the students organized this on their own and talked about what they wanted to do, and they decided that they wanted to celebrate the contributions of Southern graduates over the years. And so they've gone in and researched and found individuals that they want to highlight their careers and show what Southern University has meant to them. So that's in the Southern University Student Union Cotillion Ballroom. Tomorrow starts at 6 o'clock. And like I said, this is completely student-driven. And, they're excited about it. So we're hoping for a great turnout. It's free. It's open to the public. And the students are going to, like I said, be putting on a sort of a program. And we expect some of those that are going to be honored to come back, that have contributed to the university, that have held positions of authority at the university. Graduates of Southern that have gone on to distinguish themselves. So all of that is going to play out. March is the actual Founders Day. March 9th is we've already celebrated the Founders Day is March 9th. That's on a Sunday. So we'll have our celebration, that we do every year on March 10th this year. But, of course, it'll focus on the centennial. And then we'll have a centennial gala on April 11th, Friday, April 11th, with great entertainment coming in. Again, for that, there'll be a major fundraiser. One of the things that I really stressed when we started talking about this is that, we have to have something other than just a celebration. So we started a Chancellor's Scholarship Fund, and the committee endorsed that idea. So throughout this year, we're pushing a scholarship fund. It's becoming more and more critical for our students to be able to finance their education. Every year, I know as I sit here in the chancellor's office at the start of every semester with students coming in and understanding their situations with being able to finance their education. They're running. Whether it's short a few hundred dollars or a couple thousand dollars, it's difficult to do that. So we have to be able to help them. We have to be able to provide that assistance to them. And that, we obviously don't have the resources within our regular budget to be able to do that as much as we do. That has to come from external fundraising. So we are definitely pushing, and everything that we're doing is geared towards that. We have a link on our website on with 100 Years on the Bluff, the Centennial. And anyone can go in there. There's a link that anyone could go in and click on if they want to contribute to that scholarship fund. We let people know that 100% of every dollar given will go back to students. You know, we hope to be able to sustain it. We're telling our younger graduates, we know you can't give a lot of money. You can give a little bit. You can go to that link, use your credit card. It can be a one-time event. It can be a one-time contribution or a recurring contribution.
100 years on the bluff, and Chancellor Lorenz is calling for contributions. Southern, like every other university is in this state, has faced major budget cuts over the last few years, and the money has to be found somewhere. And 100 years of excellence on the bluff from one of the great entities in this country, Southern University. The student showcase that you referenced, Chancellor, that's tomorrow night. When and where?
The Southern University Union in the Cotillion Ballroom, Smith Brown Memorial Union.
At what time?
6 o'clock.
6 o'clock. Brandon in Central. Brandon, please be brief. You're on with Chancellor Lorenz.
Yes, Dr. Lorenz. My name is Brandon. I'm a graduate of Southern University.
All right. That's the same guy who called earlier, Donald in Mid-City. And I'm sorry, Donald, but we only allow one call per day per person. But thank you for calling. Chancellor, good luck to you next week. Any parting thoughts?
You know, just that, you know, we're proud to be a part of this community for 100 years. We believe we contribute tremendously, not only to the economy, but to the overall, you know, growth of this university. I think we're far-reaching in terms of our graduates and what they do. So, and we appreciate all the support from the community and nationally in recognizing what we've done at this great university for the past 100 years and for the next 100 years.
Well, thank you, sir. Good luck.
Thank you, Jim.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
See you at Highland Coffees.
Right. Bye-bye.
Bye. Tom Aswell, native of Ruston in Baton Rouge for 3 decades, and a man who trolls the halls of the Capitol looking for intrigue, and he finds lots of it and writes about it in Louisiana Voice, his website that's been around for a few years. And he's hot and bothered about Governor Jindal's speech last week in the great state of California, in which the governor said that we're in danger of losing our religious liberty under the presidency of Barack Hussein Obama. Good morning.
Good morning, Jim.
Why are we in danger of losing our religious liberty, Tom Aswell?
I don't think we are. I beg to differ with the governor on that point. I don't think there's any danger at all of that. I think his accusations against President Obama were misdirected. I'm not a big Obama fan myself, but I don't understand where the governor's coming from on this.
Well, he's running for president.
Of course he is.
And he was in Ronald Reagan's backyard. And I'm sure he's trying to marshal support for the Republican nomination in 2016. And this apparently is something that he and his advisors think will get him votes.
Well, it might get him a few. I don't see it as a burning issue. And I certainly don't see it as his springboard to the White House.
Well, he didn't have your vote to begin with,
no.
I don't think. But maybe he got a few votes in Simi Valley.
Perhaps.
Now, the governor, he was rather straightforward. He said that our Constitution was made for only a moral and religious people.
And
that's a direct quote, isn't it?
It was not made for the sinners. I thought our Constitution was made for all our citizens. I just don't understand why he would say something like that. Because
we all sin.
Of course we do, and the Constitution is all-inclusive.
But you can sin and still be moral and religious, right?
I suppose. All right, let's say they're immoral and irreligious. The Constitution applies to them just as it does anyone else.
Well, this is something that will be an issue in the 2016 campaign, whether Bobby Jindal's a Republican nominee or Chris Christie or somebody else. It's something that the Republican Party believes that the American people, that there's a large core of people, maybe a majority, that doesn't like the direction we're going. Is that fair game?
Certainly. I think it's fair game. I don't think anyone likes the direction we're going. I haven't liked the direction we've been going for some time now, dating back at least to the bailout of Wall Street. I wasn't a big fan of that, but that has nothing to do with threat to our religious beliefs.
There was a time when liberals in this country believed in debate. There was a time when the left preached tolerance. That's from Bobby Jindal speaking at the Reagan Foundation and Library last Thursday. Now, the governor is an opponent of same-sex marriage. Some would say that's a matter of religious liberty.
Yes, it is, and I certainly don't try to take that away from anyone. If that's your belief, that's your belief, and you're entitled to it. But coming from the most intolerant governor we've had in history, to accuse anyone of being intolerant and not in favor of debate, I think is one of the most hypocritical comments I've ever heard.
Tom Aswell, publisher of Louisiana Voice, 297-5633, if you'd like to participate. Why do you think he's the most intolerant governor in history? That's a strong statement.
Well, I mean, look at the list of people he's fired just for a difference of opinion. I mean, the list grows every day. Three legislators he's demoted from committee assignments simply because they didn't vote the way he wanted them to.
That's just politics, though.
Of course it's politics, but firing people, that's their livelihood. That's their lives.
When you take a chairmanship, you're not firing them from the legislature. They're still going to get a check.
Well, yeah, that's true. But these legislators, they treasure those plum committee assignments. And well, that's his only way of punishing them.
Some would say the governor's quite benevolent. You know, he gave state workers in this community several days off a few weeks ago when there was a little light mist in the air.
If you want to call that benevolent, feel free.
297-5633. With Tom Aswell of Louisiana Voice, he's been a journalist for many years, and he is a watchdog, somewhat like C.B. for Godston. You would take that as a compliment,
wouldn't
you? I
would take that as an ultimate compliment.
Well, what's going on with St. George? You've been reporting on that as well.
Yeah. The St. George issue... some have compared it with Central, but I don't think that's a valid comparison because Central didn't have the tax base that St. George has. St. George has Woman's Hospital. It has the Mall of Louisiana, and that would decimate the tax base for East Baton Rouge Parish. And when you get right down to it, it's all about schools and education, and I don't think anyone would deny that. I think both sides will admit to that. But how are you going to help the students that are stuck in these schools in Baton Rouge if you pull the tax base out from under them? That's the consideration I think everybody should be looking at.
Well, you have taken aim at one of the gentlemen who is leading the charge for St. George, this fellow Lionel Rainey III. He is apparently doing a very good job marshaling the troops, but you think that there's a story behind the story. What's the story?
Absolutely, I think there's a story behind it. That $717,000 no-bid contract he got, and then a month later they award an identical contract to someone else.
You throw out these numbers, $717,204, the no-bid contract from whom?
The Louisiana Economic Development Department. To create a database for employment purposes, employment recruitment. But they awarded another contract identical to that for even more a month later for the same thing.
And to Mr. Rainey?
No, to another individual and who, from her background, does stellar work, does excellent work. And she has only, I think, billed maybe $30,000+ while Mr. Rainey has gone several hundred thousand dollars.
$717,000. This was on October 20th, 2012, correct?
Correct.
So what exactly is the contract for?
That's to create a database. And Mr. Rainey, to my knowledge, had no real background in that area. Creating a database and monitoring a database are two different things, and basically what he's doing is just simply monitoring a database for employment recruitment.
Okay, we'll follow on this in just a moment with Tom Aswell and other matters, including the governor in California espousing his religious fervor. Back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and government watchdog Tom Aswell of Louisiana Voice is with us, and he's watching the money. And what was it? Woodward and Bernstein said, follow the money, follow the money. And there will be a lot of it on the plus side or the pro side and the con side for the St. George community. But you're a man who a few minutes ago was preaching liberty. If these people really want to create their new city, why shouldn't they be allowed to, Mr. Aswell?
Well, if they vote for it, I guess it's a done deal if that's what they want to vote. But I just feel like they're punishing the students in the poorer schools in Baton Rouge for strictly a personal reason. And I don't blame them for wanting better schools. I mean, we all want better schools. But I think they're doing it at the expense of students that are going to be stuck in these other schools.
Okay. 877-217-5757, wherever you may be, for Tom Aswell, who is a native of Ruston, lives in Baton Rouge. How does a guy from Ruston, you know, Bill Jones, a former state senator from Ruston, he told me that he's a lawyer. He said that in his law office in Ruston, when he reads the New York Times and a client comes in, he kind of discreetly puts it in the drawer. How does a guy from Ruston become a flaming leftist like you, Tom?
Well, I'm not a flaming leftist. I'm an independent. I'm middle of the road. I'm conservative in some aspects and liberal in others. Liberal in personal freedoms, personal liberties.
Okay. Well, Governor Jindal is running for president. And he's making the rounds, and he's of course trying to get votes from a very conservative group of people in the primaries. The voters in the Republican Party are certainly more conservative than the electorate at large, and I think he believes what he's saying. He's not being you can't accuse him of not being sincere. He's saying what he believes. In that context, here's a man who ran for governor in 2003, got 48% of the votes, ran in 2007 and received 54% of the votes, ran in 2011 and received 66% of the votes. People in Louisiana and elsewhere appear to be responding to the message from our governor.
Well, that 66% he got was 66% of 20% of the voters. There were very few people that turned out.
Turnout was a little larger than 20%.
It was right at 20%.
It was a little larger than that. But it wasn't 50.
No,
you're right.
No. And so I don't think that's a mandate by any stretch.
But he won going away. And
against a school teacher who had $20,000 in her campaign.
$18,000. Let's not go too far there.
All right. $18,000 in her campaign chest. I could win against that if I had the money that Jindal had.
All right, Tom Aswell saying the governor has been a fortunate son, and he is a son of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, born here on the 10th of June, 1971. And CB says that CB thinks a lot of the governor's appeal is the fact that he is an ethnic change to the Republican Party. He brings a new dimension.
And that, I feel, is refreshing. I don't have, I think that's a good thing. That we're including minorities in the process.
Okay, Dan downtown. Dan, you're on the air with Tom Aswell. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Do you believe that Governor Jindal, biology major in undergrad, sincerely believes in creationism, or is just pandering to the right-wing Republicans?
I think he sincerely believes in it, but there again, that flies against his background. But I think, as Jim said, I think he's sincere in that. I don't agree with it, but I think he is sincere.
And I think the majority of the people in the state are in his corner.
I won't go that far.
You won't go that far?
No, not a majority.
It's probably close.
Not a majority. No, I don't think so. I don't think there are that many people that follow his beliefs that strongly, that
but
closely.
But this creation business and schools, public schools, only got 3 no votes last time it came out.
I know it.
And in the legislature. We had 144 lawmakers.
I would like to see what they would do
if
they did that again, because we had one, Valerie Hodges, that voted for it. And then when an Islamic school tried to apply for a charter in New Orleans, she went berserk. So apparently religious freedom is only for a certain few.
Well, there are those. And she may be one. If I had them in the chair that you're in right now, they would say, bluntly, that this is a Christian country.
Yes, but it was our forefathers, contrary to what Mr. Jindal says, our forefathers were not true Christians. They were deists for the most part.
One of the people who has come out recently in opposition to Governor Jindal and other religious conservatives, some would think surprisingly and quite eloquently, I might add. In fact, in the next few days, since I mentioned it, we'll try to play his remarks on this air, saying that these people who are supporting creationism in the Republican Party are out in left field or right field, maybe that'd be
right
better,
field.
is Pat Robertson.
Really?
Pat Robertson.
Well, Jim, I missed that.
He says they need to get off this, that evolution is real, and that the Earth isn't 6,000 years old. It's many millions, if not billions, years old, and the Republicans are losing votes because of this, and looking like, I'm quoting him, looking like fools.
Well, I didn't hear him say that, but I'm very proud of him for saying it. I agree with him.
But here's Pat Robertson on one side and Bobby Jindal to the right of Pat Robertson.
That's very surprising to hear Pat Robertson take that stand.
He said it. He said it. He's a well-educated man, a graduate of Yale Law School, and he's one who is extremely conservative and has offended a lot of people with his remarks about gays and other matters. But on this one, he could have been Tom Aswell talking.
I doubt if he would want to go that far, but yeah, that's pretty much in line with what I think.
And I must say, it's with some courage for Reverend Robertson, because I'm
sure
there are many in his own flock who don't agree with him.
Yes, absolutely.
But if it comes down to this issue in the presidential election, what does that say about the country with all the other problems we have that we're going to decide an election on how old the Earth is, or how old you believe it is?
I think a candidate that runs on that is a one-trick pony. There are too many issues out there. There are too many pressing issues. The economy, for example, jobs. For heaven's sakes, those are the issues that need to be addressed. And to run on just one issue of religion, I think I think that'll bury him. I really do.
Is his stand on this any different than, say, Senator Vitter or Congressman Cassidy? They're both running for high office.
No, but I don't think you're going to hear them come out quite as extremely as he did, or to the extreme that Jindal did. I think they're going to be talking about the economy. I just don't think they're going to pander to that part of the population.
Okay, well, the governor says he has some authority on this issue because of his degree in biology from Brown University. That doesn't make any points with you?
No.
No?
Why would that give him an authority? Because, I mean, that says exactly the opposite of what he's saying. And, I mean, this is the same guy that performed an exorcism in college, for heaven's sakes. Come on.
You didn't do some crazy things in college, Tom?
I'm not governor. I'm not running for president.
No, but you're
passing
judgment
on the
governor.
I did some crazy things, absolutely.
Okay. Well, you do point out, Tom says in his column, that some of the religious intolerance that the governor could have pointed out at home are the refusal by a justice of the peace in Tangipahoa Parish to preside over an interracial marriage.
Correct.
Why didn't the governor mention that?
I don't know why he didn't. A very, very curious omission there. Where's the tolerance there? I mean, I know that's not his area in government. He doesn't preside over weddings, but I certainly think he could have spoken up at the appropriate time.
Okay, and we have another listener who asked about this pregnant teenager at a school in Richland Parish.
Does speak to his education plank, his education. Go ahead.
No, I'm listening to you.
Okay, I thought you were going to sneeze.
I'm trying.
But,
I was.
That does speak to his stand on education in his state. And to have a situation like that occur and to exist and to expel that girl for becoming pregnant, and the football player who impregnated her did not get so much as a reprimand. And then they tried to invoke a rule where they could test all girls for pregnancy at that school without any cause. And the ACLU jumped on that, and they should have. Where's the tolerance? Where's the tolerance there? That's the question that I ask.
All right. Well, the governor is a convert. He was raised as a Hindu, and he is now a Roman Catholic. So he's a man who knows about various religions, has had exposure to them. He's been a frequent visitor to North Louisiana, your home turf.
Since he got reelected.
Well, not this time, but first term, he was visiting these churches and gave very persuasive homilies.
And while he was doing so, and this comes from an old publisher of mine who was present in Winfield at a Baptist church.
Who was that?
Tom Kelly, formerly of the Ruston Daily Leader.
Yeah.
Tom Kelly told me that he was sitting in the congregation and became aware of a movement of sorts to his left, and looked down there, and they were passing out a clipboard with asking the congregation to fill in their names, their mailing address, their telephone numbers, and their email address for campaign contribution solicitations later, because they couldn't solicit during the church service.
That is bad form.
Yes, it
really is.
Of course it is.
You know, a few years ago, I went to Fred Dent's funeral, a great man, a dear friend of mine.
I knew Mr. Dent.
At the funeral, there was a candidate passing out push cards.
Unbelievable.
The candidate won.
You're kidding.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sad state.
Yeah. I mean, there's funereal etiquette, isn't there?
Yep.
And in church etiquette, you shouldn't be asking for people to give their names and numbers so you can contact them.
I went to Wiley Hilburn's funeral up in Ruston a few weeks ago.
He was a great journalist.
Absolutely. He was my professor in college, and as well as a good friend. He married his first wife was a next-door neighbor of mine, so I knew him all the way back to high school. But I was sitting in the First Presbyterian Church of Ruston, sitting next to this guy who started trying to talk about the Tea Party. He was a big Tea Party member, and I just had to look at him and tell him, I said, I don't think this is the time or place to discuss politics.
What do you think about the next few elections? First of all, the Senate race, Landrieu and Cassidy and Hollis and Manus. What's going on there?
The latest thing to come out, of course, and I know you're aware of this, is the revelation that the Koch brothers have hired professional actors on those anti-Landrieu campaign ads, and I think that's a great thing to come out and to be known. I think the ads against Mary Landrieu probably come straight from Morris Bart, because it's the same type of advertisement. They hire actors to make these outlandish claims.
Landrieu?
Yes. No, the ones that are against Landrieu.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is she going to win or lose?
It's going to be a close call, but I think Landrieu's going to win.
It's going to win. Okay.
I think so. It'll be close.
Next year we have
and of course whoever wins is going to have to turn right around and I'm sorry, I'm thinking about the other Senate race that Vitter wins.
Well, governor's race.
Yeah.
Senator Vitter running for governor, as is Jay Darden.
And if he wins, he'll appoint his successor, probably Jindal, who will have to run again in a year.
I don't think he would appoint Bobby Jindal.
I wouldn't.
And plus, Bobby Jindal's going to be running for president at that time.
Well, Bobby Jindal may have an epiphany of sorts before then.
Well, he might run.
Yeah.
He might run. But I think the smart move by Vitter would be to appoint his wife, as Edwin Edwards did, and have her serve out the term and then have it an open race with other candidates in 2016. Elaine Edwards, people may remember, was a U.S. senator, and maybe Wendy Vitter will be one too. But first, David Vitter's got to win the governor's race. Can he do that?
Well, he has the money, and for some reason, he has a charm in this state. He leads a charm life. He could very well win. I think it would be bad for the state if he does, but he could win.
Okay. You and your missive that's at Louisiana Voice about the governor and his remarks in California, you close with the song I remember is from the movie Billy Jack.
That's correct.
1971. I was 13. What was the name of the group that did that? I'm trying to think of it.
I don't know.
The Original Castle.
Yeah, that's correct.
But you remember how it ends? You've got a good...
Go ahead and cheat your neighbor.
Go ahead and hate your neighbor.
You can go ahead and cheat your friend. Do it in the name of heaven. You can justify it in the end. And that's exactly what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
I've printed those lyrics more than one time on my blog because I think they're so appropriate.
Well, we're glad you're out there doing what you do, Tom, as well. And I think you would acknowledge that sometimes you're wrong.
Oh, of course. Of course. Only a fool would not.
And when you're wrong, you point it out.
Yes.
Okay. And that's quite remarkable.
Thank you.
Thank you. Did you see where Skip Bertman had his house invaded over the weekend?
I did. The crime in Baton Rouge is really getting bad.
This is in the River Bend area, and someone breaks in his house. Police get the call at 4:40 in the morning, Saturday morning. A home invasion.
No one was hurt.
And Skip, who's almost 76 years old and I think has artificial hips and knees, he took on the burglar and got the better of him. Now that, yeah, I like that.
Good.
I like that a lot.
Did he do it with a baseball bat?
There was no word of that, but this is a guy who's an alpha male, no doubt about it. You don't take on
handy.
Skip Bertman.
Yeah.
And we commend him. And the New York Times was in Baton Rouge last week, and in its travel section yesterday, 36 hours in Baton Rouge. Did you know
that?
Yeah. Some of the places they went to, the Fleur de Lis pizza location. You've
not
been
a
there,
bad
haven't
place.
You, Tom?
I'm going to go there soon myself.
They went to Cottonwood Books. They went to the Magpie Cafe, the Red Dragon Listening Room, Teddy's Juke Joint.
Oh, great.
Coffee Call. The Blue Bonnet Swamp Nature Center, the LSU Rural Life Museum, the USS Kidd. They had a busy 36 hours.
Yes, they did. May I say add one thing about gentle speech?
Yes, sir.
Esquire magazine had a wonderful article covering that speech, and it's online. Esquire magazine's Bobby Jindal's speech. It was published, I think, over the weekend sometime. The writer, and I don't recall his name, did an excellent job of dissecting the speech and critiquing it.
They've done other features on the governor, some of which were rather flattering.
Well, this one's not.
It's not?
No, not at all.
You liked it. Why was it a criticism of our governor?
Well, you'll have to read it for yourself. It's very critical.
Okay,
very critical.
That's an Esquire magazine.
That's
perhaps
correct.
We'll be talking about it in the days to come. And thank you, Tom, as well.
Thank you.
Watchdog Supreme.
Just an observer.
Louisiana Voice. And until tomorrow, for Sashka Marchand, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.